Bill Bennett, Australian writer, producer, director, feature films and documentaries. Welcome to the Last Post podcast.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
Yeah, that's quite a list of things you've done there, Bill, and I know you've been doing things for a long time now. What drove you into the arts? I believe you were doing something else at school. You were doing medicine or something.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Brisbane. I matriculated and went to Queensland Uni and started a went to med school. My heart really wasn't in it. In fact, through the latter years of school and then when I was at university, I was freelancing as a photojournalist, coming up with stories and taking photographs and then submitting them to magazines and so forth. And that really was my real love. And then I hit biochemistry in the medical course, and that just did my head in, and I just thought, I'm not really cut out for this. So I switched across then to another course, arts law, at Queensland Uni, and then got offered a job at the ABC, and took that up.
Yeah, well, Australia and indeed the rest of the world is glad that you did that, Bill. I mean, I think I'll go back to the history of your films shortly, but you and I first made contact, I think, through some promotional work that was being done for your 2017, was it, movie Intuition PGS?
That's right.
That's right. We went to a screening at Cremorne, and an amazing film. Tell us what led you to do a film like that, and indeed, we'll get onto your new film, Facing Fear, in just a moment, but Intuition, what drove you to that?
Well, it was really curiosity. I hadn't made a documentary for, more than 20 years or so, I think. All my work had been in feature films. But something happened to me, quite a few years earlier. I was actually in New Orleans working on a big budget thriller. And I was driving to the airport early one morning. It was dark, it was before dawn. And I heard a voice as I was approaching an intersection with a green light up ahead. I heard a voice which told me to slow down. And I thought, that's odd. And in fact, I was running late, and so I went to accelerate. And the voice said again more emphatically, slow down. And I slowed down, and then this massive truck ran a red light on a cross street and just narrowly missed me. And had I not heard that voice, but more importantly, had I not acted on that voice, I would have been killed by that truck. And that moment stayed with me, and I became more and more curious as to what that voice was. And I really had three questions. What was the voice? Where did it come from? And why was my life saved? And those three questions really then compelled me to make the film.
Well, in the film, of course, you speak to many people about intuition, and you've done a similar thing, I guess, with Facing Fear, the interviews, but that's another trip altogether. I mean, you'd been doing some magnificent feature films. I think Spider and Rose, Kiss or Kill, and The Nugget in Mudgee. Actually, I think I was at the premiere for that movie back in 2003 or something like that. It was, or 2002. And then when did this new direction start? Because I was saying to you previously that it had started with Intuition, but of course, you noted that it had actually started before that.
Well, I had been trying to get this Intuition film made for quite a few years, and I've not had any success. And prior to that, I've been fairly successful at getting films made and raising money and so forth before that. And I was kind of at a bit of a sticking point. I decided that I would walk the Camino de Santiago, which is the pilgrimage route across Spain, 800 kilometres.
Right.
I'm not a Catholic. I wasn't doing it for, religious reasons at all. I just felt, once again, I felt this compulsion to do this walk. And I really do think that that was the turning point. I sort of look at my life now as being divided into two, being the period before the Camino and the period after the Camino.
Wow.
And really, the Camino really changed everything for me. It taught me a lot of very important lessons, but probably in terms of the Intuition film, it gave me it gave me the courage, really, to step up and do the film.
What did you find on the walk?
Humility.
Well, geez, that's a blessing, isn't it? That's always a blessing.
Humility.
Yeah.
You see, what happened was, I mean, I'd done a lot of training prior to the walk, and I was pretty convinced that I was going to smash it. You know, because I was fit and I was, but I had a nagging knee injury, and in fact, what happened was, about a week before I was due to set off for the walk, I really pushed it on a couple of long walks. Mm. I did, I think, 3 days in a row where I did about 35 kilometres per day with a full backpack on a hard tar out there, going from Mudgee up to Gulgong and back and so forth.
Wow.
And I buggered my knee. And so what happened was, on the walk, I had excruciating pain through most of the walk. And it was that pain, really, that humbled me. You know, suddenly I wasn't the fit, sprightly person that I thought I was going to be, and there's no way in the world I was going to smash it. Come in and smash me. And, you know, and the end result of that was a big dose of humility. Mm. And that made me then sort of reassess a whole lot of things. And also, hand in glove with that is gratitude. You know, on the Camino, you become incredibly grateful for very, very small things, like being able to get a bed for the night, you know, walking in sunshine rather than walking in rain. You know, things like very small things which you wouldn't normally sort of give much thought to, but on the Camino, they become very important. And so gratitude and humility were really the two things that I learned from that walk.
Mm. And is humility part of the spiritual journey?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't think you can really approach spiritual learning with arrogance or ego. You have to really kind of put those aside, I think, yeah.
Mm, it's an amazing thing, and it's often the small things in life that are overlooked in the rush that has become part of 21st century life. So it's a blessing that you're able to take that time and that walk. And of course, your latest movie, which is an amazing concept, and I've seen a bit of this movie, thankfully, and been able to appreciate what you're doing here. You're looking at fear, the movie Facing Fear, the interviews where you go, you were traveling the world before COVID, speaking to these experts and various people on the subject of fear. What did you find from that?
Well, look, to take one step back, the reason that I started this film on fear, and I started it well before COVID, I learned in the making of the film on intuition that fear is the biggest obstacle to intuition. And when I started to realise that, I then started to ask myself, well, what is fear and how does it work? And that was really sort of, once again, the curiosity that compelled me to move forward with making the film. What I discovered was that we need fear. You know, there's this adage that
the only thing to fear is fear itself?
The only thing to fear is fear itself, exactly. And what I learned was, in fact, that's not true. You don't need to fear fear. In fact, if anything, you need to acknowledge fear and face fear. And one of the most important people that I spoke to in the making of the film is a Harvard professor, Dr. Richard Schwartz, who's one of the world's leading psychologists.
Right.
And he's got a process called the internal family systems modality of healing, where within this process, he teaches you how to befriend fear.
Mm-hmm.
And that came as quite a shock to me, really, you know, as I was making film, that this notion of actually befriending fear and embracing fear.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of made a bit of sense to me when you talked about it, because what you do when you befriend it is that it loses its hold over you. It loses its toxicity and potency.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to realize that, in fact, the fear that you have is a warning system, or it's alerting you to something that needs to be addressed. And then you start to realize that, in fact, bloody hell, you need this fear. You need it to fix what is going wrong, whatever that might be. But of course, the problem with fear is that it's shifted from a warning system to into areas of stress and anxiety, and you know, this constant sort of drip feed of anxiety that we have that our bodies weren't built to take. And so we get sick, we start to have mental health issues and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that the film's going to be looking at, is how we rid ourselves of that.
Mm. That's interesting too. And what you said about Dr. Richard Schwartz with saying that the only thing to fear is fear itself is not true. I do remember a friend of mine had been to the dentist, and this was a long time ago, and he was in a bit of pain, and that the dentist told him to jump into the river of pain. So this was something similar to embracing what you don't initially like to lose its hold on you, I guess.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting thought. It's kind of Eastern, really, that thought. But I'm sure it's probably a technique that
dentists have to use.
The military uses for people to handle torture and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. It's a well-practiced verse, probably. Is fear an intriguing part of our life, because it can be both crippling and, as you said before, it can be something that is needed for action. So it can be crippling also?
Well, yeah, there's another one of the very important interviewees is a lady named Dr. Lissa Rankin, and she's written a fantastic book called The Cure, The Fear Cure.
Mm.
And she spent her life analysing fear, and she talks about two types of fear. What she says is true fear, which is survival fear, which is very animalistic and primitive, and then false fear, which is emotional, mental fear, which is something that we create. And most of the fear, if you analyse it and you take it right the way back to Tours, if you look at it, most of the fear that we have is false fear, which we don't need. And that's the crippling fear. The false fear is the crippling fear.
Mm.
And coming back to the Camino, Greg, one of the things that I learned on the Camino, which is fear-related, which has stayed with me ever since, and in fact it was affirmed from several people when I came to make the film, is this. That is that on the Camino, one of your biggest fears is not finding a bed, because there's a lot of people walking each day, and there's only a certain number of beds available at the end of the day, you know, in a small village or town that you're heading to.
Mm.
And so what happens is that everybody sets up really early, like before daybreak. They hurry and they rush through the day.
Mm-hmm.
They miss the beauty around them. They don't stop and smell the roses.
Mm.
They, and they look at everyone else on the Camino that day as being a competitor. You know, that person's going to take my bed. And so what happens is that this pilgrimage walk that's meant to be, you know, a sort of serene, relaxing, therapeutic kind of walk becomes this this sort of hell rush, you know, to make sure that you get a bed. And I sort of had an epiphany on the Meseta, which is a long, long stretch, a very, very straight stretch of close to 200 kilometres, flat plain. There are very few villages along the Meseta, and so the rush for beds is very intense on the Meseta. Mm. And I had this incredible epiphany on the Meseta where I thought, okay, but what's the worst that can happen tonight? The worst that can happen is that I get to the village and there's no beds. All right. Okay, so it's a clear day. It'll be a clear night. I could sleep under a tree. I could find a church somewhere and knock on the door and sleep inside on the church.
Mm.
And when I started to sort of look at this notion of what's the worst that can happen, I then started to apply that to other fears that I might have in my life.
Mm.
And it became something of a mantra for me. You know, if a fear popped up, whatever fear it might be, I fear I'm going to die of cancer, or I fear I'm going to, you know, whatever it is, you face your fear, hence the title of the film, and you ask yourself, all right, if that fear is real and if it exists, what is the worst that can happen to me? And then you look at what the worst, what the worst is that can happen. And invariably, the worst isn't that bad. You can deal with it.
Mm.
You know, you can manage it. And once you've got to that point of being able to manage your fear and go, all right, if that's the worst that can happen, I can handle that. Once you get to that point, the fear goes away.
Yes.
Really interesting.
Yes. And thank you for mentioning that and saying that, because, of course, we know that in life's realities there will be tragedies, there will be misfortunes, as well as so many magnificently beautiful times. And some people find it hard to grasp that people can actually strengthen themselves from less than favourable events in life, such as death, etc., etc. So once the fear is realised and you can see it, it becomes less daunting, I would imagine, from personal experience. And also, as you said, what is the worst thing that can happen? And sometimes sleeping in a church or under the stars may be more rewarding than fighting for a bed.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, you never know what it's like going to happen. You might sleep in a church, then you might, you know, meet someone then that says something to you that then changes your life.
Mm.
You know, things lead to things lead to things. And,
Brilliant.
But, you know, Greg, you mentioned fear of death, and this is, of course, one of the big fears that we all have.
Mm.
But I have to say, in the making of my film on intuition, I have totally changed my attitude to death.
Right.
And I'm not scared of it anymore.
Right.
Because I have come to the belief that that we are, I call it we're living in a lease. We have a lease on life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't own our life, we're leasing it.
Yeah.
And it might be a short-term lease or it might be a long-term lease, but in the end, you know, at some point that lease is going to come due. And we're going to have to leave our body and go back home. This term has come up a lot, in fact, in the making of my film on Facing Fear, the notion of going home. And we come back and we lose another body. You know, this life that we live is merely a short-term lease. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Look, I think this is so interesting. There's been some subjects that I've discussed with other people on the same matter. And I guess, once again, it is because within the confines of our own current existence, we are not sure, or we can feel that we know certain things about what will happen after death. But that's not actually true. There's a lot of things that happen to us along the journey that enlighten us. And I guess what you're talking about there is one of those things, that losing the fear of death. It must be a great empowerment.
Well, it takes that sting, you know, away. You know, it's really interesting what's happening at the moment in America, you know, with these riots and the insurgencies and so forth. And I've been looking at it very closely. I've got a subscription to CNN and MSNBC and some of the other American news networks, so I look at it quite closely.
Right.
And I hear the interviews with these people, and when you pass it down, invariably the reason they're doing what they're doing is because of fear.
Yes, exactly.
You know, racism is a function of fear. Xenophobia is a function of fear. You know, these people storm the Capitol because they have this massive fear of loss or fear of change. It all comes down to fear. And
indeed, yeah.
You know, and if we can get rid of fear, I mean, it's a wildly idealistic
good
proposition. but if we could get rid of fear, then a lot of aggression, hostility, hate, a lot of these things would disappear.
Very true, Bill, and it's very primeval. I mean, fear. I lived with a woman once who told me there were only two emotions. She said fear and love. I don't know how accurate that is, but, of course, we do see, I guess, a lot of people say, the fear of the unknown, with xenophobia and racism, etc., and fear of loss. See, that's what it's all attached to, isn't it, as you say? And I guess sitting down and talking to someone that you may be fearful of, it's a realization to you, if you're bright enough to pick up on it, it's a realization to you that there's a lot more in common than separates us. So fear is an unnecessary component of modern life, or of any life. Well, but not unnecessary, of course, as you said, we do need it, but greatly unnecessary in a lot of circumstance.
Coming back to this thing of two forms of existence, fear and love, I would actually say fear versus truth, because love is a word that I don't really understand. It can be very confusing. It can mean different things to different people.
Yeah, who does?
But truth is absolute. Love is often conditional, but truth is absolute. So if you can get to a point of understanding what the true nature of existence is, then you have no fear.
And I guess it's like happiness. There was a posting from Kurt Vonnegut who said something about happiness, and I was wondering, what is happiness? It is what is love? What is happiness?
Yeah, that's a big question.
So we look at, I guess it's a timely film too, Facing Fear, for a lot of people, Bill, because of course, particularly here in Australia, the fires, then COVID, which is an international thing at the moment, but it has, I guess, exposed a lot of people to feelings of fear they may not have been prepared for.
Yeah, no, very much so. And in fact, this website resource that I have prepared, I should explain, I've stopped production on the film, but in the interim what I've done is I've put edited versions of all the interviews up on a website called facingfearinterviews.com. So with 27 of the top, if you like, fear management experts in the world on this website. But what I've done is I've gone back and I've done Zoom interviews with all of them talking about fear during the pandemic. And it's really, really interesting, because what I wanted to do was I wanted to address fear right now. And yeah, you know, it's
fear of missing out on toilet paper.
Well, that's a funny one, isn't it? I'm sure there are people at the moment doing PhDs on that one.
We've seen all sorts of examples of human nature brought out that we hadn't seen for a while. And the people that you spoke to, I think the 27 interviews, were they all of the same accord? Were they all, were they all of the same view with varying tributaries of thought from that, or were there some thoughts that you didn't agree with, or?
No, they actually did say that. I've chosen the group quite carefully. I mean, there's one person, Dr. Bruce Lipton, who some people might know is quite famous, and he's a Stanford biochemist. And so he looks at fear from a biological point of view, but also from a spiritual point of view. He's one of these people that's really sort of straddled the world of science and spirituality. But then I interviewed a fellow that I found in Texas who was a very high-ranking Texas ranger, a military man, a combatant, and he then became a highly paid mercenary. And so I talked to him about fear from a combat situation. What was interesting about him was that, you know, he'd faced very real fear, you know, under fire and so forth. And the way that he managed fear was not by controlling the mental aspects of fear. He actually controlled his physical presentation of fear.
Right.
In other words, he calmed his breath. He did those things to center himself. So that he was of the belief that if he could control the physical aspects of fear, then the mental aspects of fear would go away, which worked for him.
That's marvellous. Go on.
James Van Praagh, who's a very famous mystic in America, he talked about global karma. Now, I've never thought about karma being applicable to planets, you know, to an entire global community.
Global karma.
Global karma, yeah. I thought that was really interesting. Well, something really I disagreed with. I mean, there are a couple of highly regarded people who surprised me in their being conspiracy theorists, you know, about this whole COVID.
Yep.
I didn't agree with them.
Some people do surprise you, yeah.
Absolutely. But with every single person that I interviewed, I asked them one question. Every person I interviewed, I asked the same question towards the end of the interview, and that was this. I said, all right, let's take a practical example. You've got a young mum, she's got two kids, she's single, she's not earning a great deal of money, and then she loses her job, and she's suddenly hit with all sorts of fears. What advice would you give her? And I asked that question to every single person that I interviewed, because I wanted some practical advice for people that are facing fear, if not necessarily in that exact situation, but something similar. And of course, I got a varied response to that. But one of the things that came through very clearly with everybody, and surprisingly, even the most esoteric mystics and spiritualists and so forth, was number one, they said stop and breathe. Because you can't do anything while you're in panic mode.
Yes.
The next is take a very realistic assessment of what your situation is, and then either ask for help or plan. And this notion of asking for help, you know, it sounds so obvious, but it's something that we don't do enough, I think. You know, when we're in trouble, we suck it in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what these people say is, don't do that. You know, you've probably got a network of people that would like to help you. Mm. Go to them. This comes back once again, Greg, to humility.
Very, very true.
You know, yeah. You know, don't stand on your pride and end up homeless. You know, go to people and ask them and say, look, I'm in this situation. Can you help me?
There's so many things attached to that. There's so many things attached to that in modern life too, Bill. You spoke about the breathing, and I guess knowing the meditative philosophy of once you breathe in deeply, then one deep breath is a meditation, and that you can see that there's nothing really out of your control apart from death. You know, but it gives you a greater scope to control things, or not control things, but to deal with things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, meditation is a great thing. So the fear, is it the fear of asking for help too, I guess, is part of the fear?
Well, exactly, because somebody said something to me really quite interesting. Another question I asked most people was, what do you believe is the greatest fear? And this one person said something that surprised me. She said, the fear of what people think of you. And I thought about that, and I thought, bloody hell, you're right. That's a big fear. That actually does stymie us and block us, and you know. But in the end, it comes down to something which I learned during the making of the PGS, the intuition film, and that is that at the base of all our fears is low self-esteem. You know, and that's something that so many people have, most of us have, is low self-esteem. And if you can overcome that, then the strength and the empowerment that comes as a result of that is massive.
So true. And is it part of our humanness to be doubtful of our own integrity and worth?
Well, I think the other thing too is that, and this comes back now to spiritual matters. I mean, I have come to the belief, and I could never, 5 years ago, I could never imagine myself having, you know, saying this to you now. But I do believe that we have help available to us in the form of guardian angels and spirit guides.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things that I learned during the making of the Intuition film is that there is this entourage of people beings that can help you if you ask, but you've got to ask and you've got to trust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not into praying. I don't necessarily believe in praying, but you've got to ask. You've got to ask for help.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And too often we don't do that.
Yeah, how wonderful. How wonderful to hear you say that, because, of course, I, on a personal level, have visualized things in life, not in too much detail, because the more detail you engage in, the more chance you have of disappointment. So there will be a general outlook on good outcomes. And most times, Bill, they've happened, you know, and right at opportunistic moments are following bad events or whatever, or chances when you thought you'd reached the end of your tether, in many ways will come somebody or something that will turn things around. I don't consider myself particularly lucky, but I do consider myself open to it.
Well, you know, Carolyn Mace, who's a very famous lady in America, Carolyn Mace said something towards the end of the PTS intuition film. She said, how do you know something is a bad thing? And, you know, I've looked at that film so many times in the editing, and then, of course, you know, when I've attended screenings and so forth, and I've thought very deeply about what she said. How do you know what's a bad thing?
Mm.
I mean, you get fired from your job, you think that's a bad thing, but then suddenly you get off another job, and that leads to a whole other avenue of your life that wouldn't have come through had you not been fired from your job. Look, I'll tell you a little story. I knew this director of photography.
Mm.
I won't go into names, but he was working on a big Hollywood movie.
Mm.
Anyway, he was having problems with the star of the movie. He was also the producer.
Mm.
And the star was picking on one of his crew, the focus puller.
Mm.
And this cameraman, this director of photography, was very loyal to the focus puller and said, look, if you fire my focus puller, then I'm walking off this film. Well, the star stroke producer fired the focus puller and the director of photography went, okay, I'm leaving. Now, this film was a huge break for this guy. It was a massive break. It was a big movie.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big sort of franchise movie. It was a big break for him. But he stuck to his loyalty, and he stuck to his, you know, the integrity of the situation, and he left the movie. So he went back home, and he was moping around. 3 days later, an even bigger star, an even bigger producer, called him up and said, I heard you're available, would you like to do my movies? Now, that bloke ended up winning an Academy Award for his cinematography.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Is it? You know, so I mean,
that's a good example.
Really interesting case for me, where you think, all right, this is a disaster. You know, maybe I've kept my integrity, but I've stepped away from this huge career opportunity.
Mm.
And you think the whole world is going to implode. And then a few days later, something even better comes along. And that's what I've discovered life is all about. You know, in a book that I wrote associated with the film, the book is called, say, PGS Intuition, I say, rejection is just the universe shunting you in the right direction.
How brilliant. Mm, mm,
mm. Think about that. Rejection is just the universe shunting you in the right direction. We all get rejected all the time, you know, for all sorts of things.
Mm.
We get rejected in relationships, we get rejected in work, we get rejected in various things.
Mm.
But if you consider that rejection is just the universe shunting you in the right direction, then suddenly you look on rejection as being something that you should be thankful for.
Yes, yes, yes. I understand.
Thank goodness I didn't go in that direction. Thank goodness that relationship ended. Thank goodness I was fired from that job, or whatever it is.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, because even rejection for a writer too, as you know, Bill, and I used to send in stuff and I'd occasionally get yes, but a lot more no. But you may end up appearing in a publication, or your movie may be screening to an audience that then appreciates. So there's so many things that can come from that, as you just said.
When you look at J.K. Rowling, probably the most successful writer in recent history.
Mm.
You know, so she writes all the Harry Potter books, and she's immensely wealthy, and she's immensely famous, and so forth. And then she writes a crime novel under the name of Robert Galbraith.
Mm.
And she sends it out anonymously to publishers. And she gets these horrible rejection letters saying, you can't write, you know, and give up trying to write, you stink. And this is, had they known that this was J.K. Rowling's that they were sending this rejection letter to, they wouldn't have said this.
Mm.
But she kept all these rejection letters, and she made them available to aspiring writers, saying, look, this can happen to me as well, so don't take rejection.
Wow. Wow. So, yes, and of course, as you say, rejection is a part of life and it happens to us all. You know, the interesting thing about your new movie project, Facing Fear, the interviews too, Bill, is that it is attached to intuition, of course, and then I guess the more fear, the less intuition?
Well, fear just makes you blocks intuition stone dead, because... For you to be able to access your intuition, you need to be able to trust. You need to be able to trust that inner voice or that guidance or whatever it is, that sense of knowing. You need to trust that that's the way to go. A lot of people are able to access their inner voice or their inner guidance or their knowing, but then they don't have the balls then to follow through with it.
Yep.
Because they're moribund with fear. And if they could let go of the fear and run with that intuitive guidance, then their life would be so much easier.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this is the important message about fear, and you bring this to an audience that really should be lapping this sort of message up, because it is so timely, but it's also timeless too, Bill. It's something that's been around, which leads me to, when does fear first enter a person's life? Is it with us when we're born? I suppose it is instinctively, but they would see examples of reasons to be fearful. I guess that's why the different people react in different ways. Some grow up in more fearful or environments that lend to fear.
Well, again, it comes down to survival fear versus manufactured fear, if you like.
Mm.
You know, as youngsters, we have survival fear. We, you know, we have an instinct that we shouldn't get close to the edge of a cliff.
Mm.
And things like this. But I must admit, our environment, our parenting in particular, does promulgate fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as parents, I mean, I wish. I've got three children. I wish I could have another go. But children, of course, don't do what you tell them to do. They do what they see you do.
Mm.
And if they see you in fear, then they're going to be in fear as well.
Very true. Very true. Bill, it's been absolutely magnificent speaking to you, and I would recommend to everybody, bar none, that they have a look at Facing Fear, the interviews. It's an amazing project, and we can only hope and we trust and we believe that your future work will be, again, embracing so many of these issues that maybe people might be fearful of dealing with. Can I say that?
You know, I'd like to do a third film in the series, which I'm calling The Veil, and it looks at death and looks at what happens when you die. Because I fear with intuition, fear, and death, the three are sort of circular.
Mm-hmm.
They're all interconnected. But thanks for that, Greg. I very much enjoyed talking to you. It's, you know, look, as we go through life, I become more and more curious, and in a sense, these films are very selfish films, because they provide me an opportunity to explore my curiosity. And
this,
I figure, if I can become curious and sort of answer some fundamental questions about things and put it in a form that people can understand, then it will help other people as well. But if people are interested in looking at Facing Fear, the interviews, the website is facingfearinterviews.com.
Facingfearinterviews.com. Bill, yep. You speak about curiosity. We could speak for hours because, of course, curiosity is a necessity. And I guess also just a final question to you, or more an observance from my point too. There are some people that dead set do not believe in things like, if you mention the word spirituality to them, they become a bit dismissive. Some people, I've discussed this with some people, like I said, they say, no, there's no such thing as spirituality and things like that. Where does that come from?
Well, they become very aggressive as well. I've been in situations where people have really become very abusive and aggressive. I think, fuck it, what are you scared of, man? But that's okay. I mean, you know, it's people come at it at different times in their life, and it may not be this lifetime that they come at it at all. You know, it's not my job to try and convince people that something exists or doesn't exist. You know, it's there for people to explore should they wish to, but everybody has their time. What I've noticed is that oftentimes people come to it after a calamitous time in their life. Either a major relationship has broken down, or they've lost everything in a financial hardship, or there's been some sort of thing like a bushfire, or a major death in the family, something like that. And something has jolted them into searching for more meaning in their life. You know, for those people who don't believe in the spiritual aspects of this existence, I go, oh, okay.
That's right. Can't do much about that, friend. I can't do much about that at all. But it's a beautiful thing to be attached to it, I believe. And it's a pleasure to speak with you, obviously, a man who has gone beyond what he started to be as a director and producer. And you've started to do some, you've always done a lot of amazing work. But this is on a new realm altogether. And it's much appreciated by all of us, Bill. So thank you.
Well, very, very kind of you to say, Greg. Thank you very much.